Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Remember the old story about the country bumpkin meeting up with the city slicker? If you're going to survive city life, then you've got to have some street smarts. Well, the same principle holds true for translocated elk, something Dr. Jackie Fryer learned in her research on elk survival. And tiny mites that live in the soil may hold the key to successful reclamation of oil sands areas. That's what Dr. Jeff Battaglia is studying as part of his Alberta Ingenuity Industrial Associateship on soil health. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. You don't see many elk in Alberta, except around Jasper, Banff, and of course, Elk Island National Park. Yet in the days before European settlement, elk roamed from one end of the province to the other. Efforts to re-establish elk populations usually involve translocation, quite literally transporting herds from one location to another. But whether they survive the move is another story. Dr. Jackie Fryer is a recent PhD graduate from the University of Alberta, and she spent the last 5 years studying the survival rates of these translocated elk.
In Alberta, the story is much the same as it has been all across North America. The elk ranged nearly throughout the province to within a few hundred kilometers of the Yukon Territory's border. But at about the turn of the 20th century, they were nearly eliminated from the province. Only a few tiny herds were left, mostly relegated up into the mountain areas. And that resulted primarily from a broad-scale conversion of land to agriculture after human settlement, overhunting, and there were a series of years of really massive fires throughout the Rocky Mountains and severe winters that compounded the problem that left us with very few herds. So the management has been focused on eliminating the factors that caused the reductions in the herds, habitat-related and mortality-related factors, as well as translocating animals and trying to reestablish populations in areas where elk had been eliminated from, and that continues today.
Now, translocating elk, what does that mean and where are they coming from?
Okay, what that means is physically capturing animals in one location where there's enough that you can take from the population without hurting the population stability and moving them to another area and releasing them on the spot and hoping that they take and establish a population there. Where that's been happening in recent years in the province, there's a couple of areas that have consistently had populations that exceed what we call social carrying capacity. In the town sites of Banff and Jasper National Park, you've heard about the elk and the interactions between elk and humans that can become quite dangerous when they get habituated to human activities. Those animals have been a source of translocations into the areas that we're interested in establishing or enhancing elk populations. Another area is the Millerville area southwest of Calgary, an agricultural fringe population where there's problems with vehicle elk collisions and the potential for agricultural depredation. And hunts in those areas have been very difficult to implement to reduce that population because it's mostly private land and there's been antagonism against seeing those hunts happen. And so translocations have been implemented. And the last source is Elk Island National Park, which being fenced and a very productive system, those animals could possibly technically eat themselves out of house and home. There's so many of them. And the system, so instead of having disease outbreaks and the kinds of things that happen with large populations that can't emigrate out of the area, they translocate on a regular basis. And Elk Island is a source for translocations all over North America.
What has your research been focused on?
What we focused on is the Central Foothills area was there were several interests in the central foothills of the Rocky Mountains, one being on what are the factors limiting the local population, and the second being what are the ways that we might enhance that local population. There's a thought from the managers that industrial activities have created considerably more habitat than is currently occupied by elk in the areas through cut blocks and the creation of pipelines and such. And so elk are highly traditional in their habitat use patterns, and they're not likely to discover new areas because they don't disperse into them, but we might be able to, through translocations, be able to create patterns of use that will exploit some of these new areas. And so translocations have been happening into the central foothills for the last several decades. One of the problems has been that the animals that were released hadn't been followed very effectively. They'd been ear tagged, but only anecdotally did we know whether they lived or where they might have moved to through harvests and things like that. Some other research has estimated about a few thousand elk to occupy this core area that we were interested in. And interestingly, a few thousand elk had been released into that area in the 90s. And we have no idea as to what the effect on the local population was, if any. So that's where this study picked up.
So what did you do?
Well, the thing that we were most interested in were what could affect the success of translocations. If we want these animals to stay and survive in this area, what are the important factors? And because we had these different source populations that had different experiences with hunting and wolves, the major mortality factors in the central foothills, then we had the opportunity to say, first of all, does it matter where you come from as to whether you'll stay and as to whether you'll survive? And the second question is there sufficient spatial variability in how wolves are distributed and human risks are distributed throughout the landscape that we could exploit, and so that we could match the experience of the source population to the place that we put them to optimize translocations, if you will.
How many elk were you moving?
We had the opportunity to move close to 500 animals over the period of four different winters between the year 2000 and 2005. And of those, we monitored about 136 adult females, and that's what we paid attention to because they were the most important component for establishing the population.
How did you monitor them? Did you use radio collars?
Yes, indeed. We put radio collars on them and did regular flights every 2 weeks to see were they still alive. And if they hadn't, then we'd get in on the ground and find out what had killed them. And it actually took quite an effort to keep up with some of them because we had some big movers in the end.
Well, I'm curious about how you actually rounded up these elk in the first place to move them. What was involved in that? It must have been quite something.
That's right. It is quite something. And the parks and a volunteer down in the Millerville area associated with the Cross Conservation Area took care of all of the trapping efforts. And what it largely entailed was a big fenced-in area where in late winter or midwinter, they would put out hay and attract the animals into and shut the gate behind them. So catching is actually the easy part. And then it takes a whole lot of people to push these animals, once you have them in the captive facility, through cattle runs and what's called chutes, to run them through, get them into what we call a squeeze, where we can hold the animals quite tightly and put collars on them, take blood samples and do testing or administer vaccinations, all the things we might have to do before we move them. And then after that, we load them up onto cattle trailers, and the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has a lot of experience in moving animals all over North America. And they provided the trucks and the trailers and the drivers and took the animals on cattle trailers out into the central foothills to the different sites that we'd picked out to expose them to and let them go.
Well, once you let them go, when they kind of came off these trucks, what was their reaction? How was it for them coming off and going into this new location?
Well, I'm not sure what they thought, for sure. But I think for sure they realized, they weren't in Kansas anymore and it was something different. And we had several different patterns of movement. And it's from their movement patterns that we infer the behavioral processes that were going on. And some animals settled quite quickly, intermixed with the resident population quickly and stayed. Some animals picked up immediately and left and moved quite considerable distances in the end. From the start to the last location, we know on some animals it was upwards of 160 kilometers. We had one go right through the mountains and end up in Golden, BC, in fact. But the majority of animals, more than 50% of them, stayed within 30 kilometers of the site we released them. And there were a variety of patterns of stay through the winter, explore a little bit in the summer and return, or pick up and just move to the neighboring area, but still within about 30 kilometers of where you started. And that was what the majority did.
How did they make out? How did they survive through that first year of release?
That's right. Well, the first year turned out to be really critical to them. We had a large mortality pulse that happened in that first year. We had a survival rate between only 25% and 50% in the first year. And 70% of all the mortalities we observed over the whole course of our 5-year study was during that first year.
Why? What was happening?
Well, what was clearly happening was the first few months right out of the release. One, the animals are being moved in the winter, which we all know the animals are having a poor body condition the longer the winter progresses. Two, we're putting them out into an area where they don't know the distribution and abundance of the food. They may not be equipped to find it efficiently and utilize what they find efficiently. And three, they were faced with novel mortality risks. If you'd never seen a wolf before, well, I guarantee you're in trouble in a deep snow condition when you do come across them. And so very initially, right off the bat, in the first few months following the release, we had a pulse in wolf predation and a very few starvation incidents. Very, very few what we call capture myopathies, which was the animal went through so much stress in captivity that it failed to, you know, the stress itself can create a condition that we call capture myopathy that can cause animals to drop for no apparent reason. And so we only had two incidences of that happening out of the 136 that we looked at. And then those that made it through the summer, then we had another pulse in the fall that was due to hunting in the area. And in our area, for adult females, that was only native hunting by treaty rights or poaching.
How high was the mortality due to hunting?
In that first year, we had an equivalent number of elk taken by wolves as by the native hunters.
Okay, you had quite a few die off then for a number of reasons. What about the ones who survived? Then what happens?
That's right. Well, by the end of that first year, as the animals start going into their second winter in our study area, they had settled a home range. They were behaving very similarly to what we observed in the resident population. They still moved more than the residents did, but considerably less than they used to. And they didn't pick up and move to new areas anymore. And their survival rates did not differ from the residents anymore. So they seemed to have to start to do a behavioral pattern, perhaps staying closer to cover more, avoiding roads, things like that we see in the resident population that equilibrated their survival rates and they mediated their own mortality risk.
So they actually changed or modified their behavior?
They must have. It's not something that we could observe very effectively, but we do have someone investigating right now looking at very detailed movements to our locations to try to get at that. The problem is the collars that we use, the battery runs out after the first year, and so we don't have the detailed movement behavior from the first year to the second year to really get at that very well, but they must have changed their behavior.
What would be the implications or the significance then of what you've learned from this study?
Well, as far as the elk study goes, we learned a lot for this local population and certainly for improving translocations here. The first is that it does matter where you come from and whether you were ever exposed to wolves or hunters before. Animals from Banff Park or from the Cross area where they were familiar with either wolves or either hunters but not wolves, had a survival rate twice that of the Elk Island animals who had never experienced wolves or hunters before. And that's despite the fact that the Elk Island animals were coming into the study area and being released in what we consider to be the best body condition of all the animals. They were the largest and apparently the most fit coming off because they came out of such a productive area. And that is important as well for considering other studies elsewhere. There's a lot of conservation of trying to recover critically endangered populations. There's a lot of birds in New Zealand, for instance, that since the introduction of cats and stoats and things like that to New Zealand, populations plummeted and they've been recovered, but only on predator-free islands, and now they need to introduce them into areas that contain predators. And so if you can condition those animals to be somewhat experienced to those predators, you may be able to double their survival rate in a release area. And this is the first study that actually was able to document the effect of experience to these risks in a translocation setting. And secondly, we learned that there is a lot of variability, spatial variability. We can predict largely where wolf mortality and human mortality occurs as a function of landscape features. With respect to wolves, it's a function of the things they use for travel corridors. Seismic lines were very important. You're much more likely to die from a wolf near a seismic line than further away from it. And that's been also seen with caribou elsewhere in this province. With respect to humans, it was road-based, and you were much more likely to die from a human than from any other cause near roads. And so we could map these risks across the landscape, and then we can map the habitats elk were likely to stay in and merge the two together to be able to identify areas that are going to be optimal for future translocations.
Are there still any question marks for you after doing this study?
Sure, there are some outstanding questions from this research. One is whether what's called a soft release would help to maintain animals, to increase their site fidelity after release versus what we did, which is called a hard release, where you open the truck and let them go. And we're interested in this question because, one, we saw that animals, where they were likely to stay following release, actually potentially carried higher mortality risks. Now, we're not sure exactly why, but they were tending to stay in areas that had a higher herbaceous biomass, and living in those areas made them incur higher mortality risks from hunters and wolves. Now, the resident population in our study shows that they're using areas of low to intermediate biomass, so perhaps that's part of that behavioral thing that they learned to use the habitat differently over time. But could we modify that by enclosing the animals in a facility at the release end so that they will settle down before we release them and utilize areas that are less risky to them from the get-go once they're more familiar with the habitat is a good question to ask for future research.
So really what these elk need to do is get their street smarts, eh?
That's right. Studiers of Sun Tzu in The Art of War would realize that knowing thy enemy is one of the most important things when you're going into battle, and certainly having some experience with the main mortality risks that these elk were about to face after release was certainly the key to improving translocation success.
Thank you very much, Jackie.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Jackie Fryer, a recent PhD graduate in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. Her elk research was sponsored in part by the Alberta Conservation Association. Oil sands production destroys forests, there's no question about it. So a lot of research is underway to better understand how we can rebuild those lost forest ecosystems once the mining is finished. Dr. Jeff Battaghelli is a soil ecologist working with Paragon Soil and Environmental in Edmonton. He's one of the latest recipients of an Industrial Associateship Award from Alberta Ingenuity. This award will support his research on oil sands reclamation. His interest is arthropods, little mites that inhabit the soil of the forest floor.
We've got sites on three areas, one with Syncrude, one with Suncor, and one on Albion Sands. In total, we've got about 65 plots that include a variety of soil reclamation prescriptions, as well as natural forest types in the area.
When you look at these different sites, what happens when an oil sands spot goes in? How do they actually remove the soil before they get around to reclaiming it?
From what I've seen, they're going in and stripping off all the top organic material and then digging down into the oil sands themselves. So they've gone down, in some cases, several hundred meters into the ground. So then they have to fill that hole back up again, usually with the tailing sands that come after the process. And then they're putting organic matter back on top of that. So that's a lot of peat moss or forest floor from the next area that they're going to dig from. And that goes on top, and then that's what they're reclaiming from that area or from that site.
Do they use different methods?
We're looking at six different prescription methods, and those have changed over time as well. So we've got some older sites that have used a specific type of reclamation procedure, and now we've got some newer sites that we're looking at, and those, again, have different procedures as well.
How would they differ?
They differ from the types of material that they're using on those sites. In some instances, they've just used direct placement of the tailing sands. In other instances, they're using a tailing sand covered with forest floor material or tailing sand covered with peat moss.
Now, you said that you're studying arthropods in these different sites. How is that working? What is it that you're actually looking for?
I'm looking at the arthropods that live in the soil, specifically mites and springtails that live in the ground. And we're looking at the diversity and distribution of different organisms, different species in those sites. And so far, it's going to be very interesting because not a lot of work has been done in northern Alberta. So we're looking at a lot of really basic sort of research into the distribution and diversity of organisms there.
What do those little mites tell you about the health of the soil?
You've got different organisms that respond in different ways to their environment. So certain species really like to be in a habitat that's not disturbed. So you'll have a lot of those sorts of organisms in undisturbed natural forests. In a disturbed forest, the ones you'll find in these reclaimed areas, those species won't be there, and there'll be another group that'll take over the bulk of the community there.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It just is. So you're looking as the sites are reclaimed, as they develop over time, you get a change in the structure of the overall community. And that's just a natural process of succession on those sites.
What does it tell you, though?
In certain systems, you've got these really diverse, large communities of organisms that show up. So in the natural systems, you get a lot of orbatid mites, as an example. And they like to live in systems that are not disturbed, that are fairly stable and long-lived sort of sites. In a disturbed system, you'll see a lot of prostigmatid mites, as an example. And certain families within the group of prostigmatid mites are really well developed to live on a disturbed system. So they can reproduce very quickly. They can take advantage of food resources that appear. So you'll have these a large density of these organisms on those sites. And as the site recovers, the longer it develops and reestablishes itself, you get a buildup of organic matter, you have more resources showing up, the climate and the habitat becomes more stable. You'll get a reintroduction of those orbatid mite species, and the prostigmatid mite species can't compete with those organisms, so they will start to drop off, and they will move to other habitats that are disturbed again as the site becomes reestablished back to what could be normal, quote-unquote. You'll have the old system reestablish itself, so you'll have those long-lived species that, like the non-disturbed habitats, show up.
What role do they play in the soil?
The soil organisms themselves are really an integral part of the soil system. So they help with breakdown of organic matter. They help to recycle nutrients. They help with soil structure in the habitat. And that becomes very important in a disturbed system because there's not a lot of things that are going to help retain nutrients, spread nutrients around, break down organic matter.
Why would you use these insects as opposed to some other species?
Species of insects, I think, are, especially insects living in the soil, are a lot more interesting because they're integrated into the soil system itself. A lot of people look at the soil chemistry and soil physical properties, but another big component of the soil ecosystem is the biological component. So looking at the soil organisms, they will be affected by changes in soil chemistry and soil physical properties, but they will also affect change on the soil chemistry and soil physical properties as well. So it's a big integrated sort of system that I think needs to be looked at as a whole.
You've been working on this for about a year now. What are you finding out?
We did a quick preliminary study last fall, and we found that most of the disturbed reclaim sites have a much lower diversity and density of soil arthropods than the control sites, and that's something we would expect in this sort of study. Ideally, now that we're trying to set up this sort of baseline for it, we'd like to follow that over the long term and see how these systems recover from those disturbances.
Jeff, how long does it take then for these communities of insects to reestablish themselves to the way they were in a natural forest?
That's a really good question. We've seen in some studies in North America and even in Europe, even 20, 25 years after the forest has been harvested, you don't get the same diversity of species that you find in the natural forest. So we could be looking at anywhere from 25 to 50 years before we start to see something close to what you'd see in the natural forest systems.
Why does it take so long?
I think it takes a long time, probably because of the size of the area that you're dealing with and the speed at which these organisms can move. You got to remember that some of these things are, half a millimeter in size, so they're not moving very quickly or they're not moving very far. And I think part of it is a long time to recolonize an area. Another thing is that it takes a long time for these systems to reestablish themselves to provide that habitat that they need to live in.
Well, what do they do for the soil? I know in my garden, when I see earthworms, this is supposed to be a good thing because they go through and they help break down the soil and add good things to it. Is that the sort of thing that happens with these insects that are in the soil?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. The organisms in the soil are responsible for decomposing organic matter. They're responsible for helping with the physical structure of the soil system. They're responsible for retaining nutrients and releasing nutrients for the plants to take those things. So they play a really important role in the overall functioning of the soil system. It's not just adding fertilizers and making sure the soil's aerated that's going to allow the plants to grow. These organisms provide a lot of services that we probably take for granted and don't realize they do. And I think because they do those things and they do them for free, basically, it's something we should probably look at, retaining their services in the long run.
When you're finished this research, how is it going to be applied? What sort of recommendations can you make about reclamation methods?
Well, I'm hoping that we can take the information from my study and incorporate it into the reclamation procedures, looking at changes to soil chemistry and soil physical properties, and provide a better overall picture as to how reclamation practices influence the recovery of the soil ecosystem, and ideally use the soil arthropods to see if the system is recovering in the proper way, and if it's not, provide a quicker indicator for a problem in the system at that time, instead of waiting 20 years or 30 years for trees to establish or not to establish. We can look at the soil community and say, you know what, we're missing a really big chunk of the community here. Why is that? We need to address that situation and do it sooner so we can reclaim these sites in a better, more efficient manner.
Is there anything standing out for you right now that sends up a red flag?
Not so far. A lot of this work, because it's a really baseline sort of information, I'm kind of in a gee whiz sort of situation, because a lot of the stuff is very interesting to see for the first time, and it's going to take a little while to wrap our heads around what's there and compare that to other situations that are similar.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Jeff Battaghelli, a soil ecologist with Paragon Soil and Environmental, and a recipient of an Alberta Ingenuity Industrial Associateship. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity, Calgary Technologies, Inc., the Sustainable Forest Management Network, University of Lethbridge, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Innovation and Science, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.